House Labor and Commerce is now coming to order. It is 3:30 on March 28th. With us, we have Representative Chenault, Representative Herron, Representative Josephson, Representative Johnson, and we've got one member in transit and two excused. Representative Millette and Ryan Bold are both excused. Representative Johnson is our alternate, and again, he is with us today and sitting to my left, for those of you that don't know him. We have a number of items on the calendar today. From bills previously heard, our first item on the calendar is House Bill 60, Uniform Real Property Transfers Upon Death. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If I might add, we have had a previous presentation on the bill. The CS version C was moved, but an objection was maintained. When the bill was set aside, and this time I'd like to remove my objection to adopting the CS version / C. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, that will be the working document. Representative Gruenberg, a brief recap, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Max Gruenberg from District 14, Boniface and Russian Jack. Thank you for hearing House Bill 60 again and for considering and adopting the CS. This is the Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Deed Act. And what it allows you to do is to sign a deed that is effective upon your death and record it now. And you can revoke it later. You can supersede it with another deed. The person can disclaim it as long as that is recorded so that the chain of title is very clear. If it's a wild deed or a will or something that's not recorded, it generally will not supersede it. So people will be able to just look at the chain of title. 21 other states have it. 4 states more are considering it. It's now a uniform act, and everybody's adopting the uniform version. The latest to adopt this was South Dakota, I think, earlier this year. And it will help a lot of people. AARP has endorsed it. We've just gotten a letter from the Commission on Aging. The realtors have endorsed it. It was suggested by a senior citizen here. I'm not aware of any opposition to it, except some lawyers who are maybe afraid of losing a little business. But I will be working on it in the next committee of referral, some tweaks and stuff. And this will allow it to get moved on, and hopefully will help some people with some estate planning. Thank you.
Any questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, we will reopen public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Seeing none, we'll close out public testimony. Any committee comments or thoughts or questions? Seeing none.
Representative Johnson. Mr. Chairman, I move CS for HB 30 version C from committee with individual recommendation on attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee. Brief it is. Calendar is House Bill 230. Also under bills previously heard. Carrying the bill is Representative Paul Seaton. Thank you for joining us again. And we first heard this bill on the 21st of February, then again on March 14th and March 24th. During that time, we took public testimony. Today, it's my intention to adopt 2 amendments and move the bill on to the next committee. At this time, I'll remove my objection to adopting CS House Bill 230 version N. Is there any further objection to adopting version N? Seeing none. The CS is adopted as the working document. Representative Seaton, could you give us a brief summary on this version?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This version again allows aided development bonds for oil and gas processing facilities on the North Slope so that we can get more oil, especially from small independents, into the pipeline in a sooner time frame. It also changed some language and put at the suggestion of legal that we could more easily incorporate the tax credit by putting that on page 2, lines 21 through 23. And, Mr. Chairman, that is the part that has caused the problem, which is the subject of the amendment.
Any questions for the sponsor on the CS? Seeing none, we do have two amendments in the packet, and I would ask the members to get out amendment number N.1. And Representative Seaton, could you walk us through the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll entertain a motion to adopt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Amendment number one. And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. N.1 just removes the insertion of the oil and gas processing facilities into the section of the bill which would also have affected SB 21 tax credits. So there was no intention to do that, and when we realized that, we figured we'll just eliminate that from the bill because there's no intention to impact those.
I think that made a lot of people happy. Is there any further objection to amendment number one? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. Amendment number one passes. Representative Seaton, we also have another amendment. N2, if the members could get N.2 out. And I'll entertain a motion to adopt amendment number two.
Mr. Chairman, I move we adopt amendment number two.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, I wanted to thank Representative Sadler for pointing this out. It's a inversion of words in this and needed to be clarified. So it's just a contextual change of order of words.
For the record, he is the dictionary to the Labor and Commerce Committee.
You think.
Thank you.
He's the what?
Dictionary. Well, with that, any discussion for Representative Seaton? I'll remove my objection to N.2. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, the amendment passes. Now we're back to the full bill. Any committee discussion? Seeing none, public testimony was closed after the last meeting. What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move CH for HB 230 version in as amended from committee with individual recommendation attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill moves out of committee and we'll take a brief at ease. Okay. And I'd like the record to reflect that Representative Sadler has been with us virtually since the beginning, and I don't believe I put you on the record, but he has been here. Next item on the calendar today is House Bill 281, Prescription Without a Physical Examination. We have heard this bill. We have taken, let's see, have to catch up with the bill. Two more pages. We heard this bill on March 17th and again on March 26th. During the last meeting, we had some technical difficulties, but we were able to take a good portion of the public testimony. There was an amendment and a last-minute minor amendment to the CS. In your packets, you have a CS that incorporates both of the amendments. And with that, I would request that we adopt the amendment as the working document backslash N.
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for HB 281 backslash N as a working document.
I will object for purposes of discussion. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Representative Lynn Gaddis. I represent House District 9, the greater Wasilla area. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. The CS speaks to, and I apologize for not recognizing how we were going to do this, whether I was going to put CS forward, so on. But it essentially speaks to working with the Department of Corrections and working with the with HESS as far as what they're already doing now, and so that we could work around it so that it doesn't change some of the good telemedicine that both of those agencies are already doing.
And it was, I might add, it was our intent to put out a CS so we would have a clean work product to, when we, assuming we move it out of committee, it'll be ready to go on without waiting for
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for the sponsor on the CS?
Just quickly, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Joseph.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Geddes, the part that deals with the corrections concerns is 1B, right? Right at the bottom of page 1?
We're working with version U, correct?
Version N?
Yeah.
Okay. And I apologize. I don't have version N with me. I have it now. Okay. Could you please ask the question again?
The part that the corrections department was concerned about is fixed by 1B. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. I have no other questions.
Pardon me?
I have no other questions.
Oh, thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, I will lift my objection to adopting the CS. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, the CS is adopted. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Seeing none, looks like we got it all in the last meeting. With that, I'll close out public testimony. Any discussion with the sponsor of the bill or committee discussion?
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chairman. I'm feeling better about this legislation. I mean, I remained a little concerned about the March 18th letter from the State Medical Board. And I don't know if they're just a tough nut to crack, with all due respect to them. I don't know them. But beyond that, I am feeling somewhat more comfortable with it. I have no other comments.
Any further comment? What is the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for HB 281 version N from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee, and we will take a break for these. Back on the record, but we're going to jump out of order briefly and bring up House Bill 288. And we're not going to be hearing the bill today, but we have requested a new CS for the bill, and the sponsor has requested that we hold the bill over to a future date, and we will be doing that. So that takes 288 off the calendar, and we will go back to a brief at ease. Out of order, next item on the calendar today will be House Bill 302. Let's see, Lynette Berg, are you with us? Yes, you are. Thank you for joining us today, and it's all yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Chairman Olson and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Lynette Burge, and I am staff for Representative Steve Thompson, who is sponsor of House Bill 302.
Before we get too far into it, I'm going to ask the members pull out the CS out of their packets, and can I have a motion to adopt the CS?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for HB 302 version in as a working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. HB 302 was drafted in response to the Alaska State Board of Public Accountancy's FY 2013 annual report recommendations. The CS for House Bill 302 addresses Alaska Statute 0804080, the professional rules of conduct for the profession of public accounting. This section of the statute sets the time that the Board of Public Accountancy must notice the adoption of any rules or amendment and its effective date to each holder of a license or permit. The CS for HB 302 amends the number of days for noticing from 60 days to 30 days. This time frame is in line with the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing Guidelines. I'll be glad to answer any questions the committee may have, and would like to also point out that we have Karen Tarver, who is a CPA and board member of the Public Accountancy here, and also Jeff Johnson should be online.
Members have any questions for the sponsor, Representative Sadler?
Ms. Burge, why was there 60 days instead of 30 days when this was, I assume when it was originally passed? Why did it go longer?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that was the way the statutes were written, and it just really is kind of a housekeeping item because it didn't match with the division guidelines. And as the board was going through the different statutes that apply to the profession of public accountancy, they noticed that there was a discrepancy. So that came into their recommendations to call attention to that to see if we can go back to what the division guidelines are.
So we have just a clerical error, or did you go back to the original passage of the bill that included 60 days? Was there a specific mention of 60 or 30 days?
In the statutes, I can give you the statute number through the chair, Representative Sadler. It's 44.62.190. And it's the guideline the division uses for noticing changes to the regulations. And A says, at least 30 days before the adoption, amendment, or repeal of a regulation, notice of the proposed action shall be, it's dot, dot, dot.
Okay. Just want to make sure there wasn't some reason originally for 60 days.
Good. Or St. Joseph?
No question.
You got off light? And with that, we'll open up public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online that, hearing none, I will lift my objection to adoption of the CS, and the CS is now before us. Are there any committee comments? What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for HB 302 version in from committee with individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee and we will take a brief at ease. Back on the record, the next item on the calendar today is House Bill 328. The committee first heard this bill on March 10th. During that time, we took public testimony and held the bill over. It's my intention to adopt the amendment the members have before them in the packet and complete public testimony and bring the bill back to the committee. With that, let's see. I'd entertain a motion to...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number in, number one, that is designated in two.
Yeah. And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Welcome back, Representative Benny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come to you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman Olson. For the record, I'm representing Benny Novak. I'm here to ask for your support to move out House Bill 328. House Bill 328 establishes a board of massage therapists and provides regulation for certification. The massage therapists brought this bill to me and they have asked for a few changes before you in amendments N1 and N2. With your permission, I'd like to introduce my staff, Mary Asbrook, Slusher, to speak to the amendment and help answer questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Olson. For the record, I'm Mary Abachzuk-Schlosser, Staff Representative Nariak. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the time today. Right now, it looks like we're on Amendment 1, labeled N2, and the coalition asked for this change because the International Association of Structural Integrators wanted clarification in their exemption. The buffers have very high standards, and they wanted to make sure those standards were included in the exemption in this bill. So that's the first part, page 7, line 31, to clarify their standard. And the second change on Amendment 1 and 2 is in the definition to insert that massage therapists do not practice physical therapy. The physical therapist brought that forth and wanted to make sure that that was clear in the definition of massage therapy. And those are the changes there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Early on in the session, there were a group of people that were talking about licensure. They weren't physical therapists. They weren't massage therapists. They were some other group. Have they been carved out as well? And do you know what I'm talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Okay. All right. Well, hopefully they have an advocate in the building. It just crossed my mind that there was a group that had met and wanted some sort of official recognition for their discipline, but they weren't. Sports therapists, perhaps?
Sports therapists.
Yeah. Are they
athletic trainers? Yeah.
Athletic trainers. Are they noted in this?
I believe they're covered by another bill, I believe.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, for speaking up.
No, no problem. Yeah, there's a separate bill in the building.
All right. Thank you.
Any further questions? With that, I'll lift my objection to adopting the amendment. Any further objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, it is adopted. Is there anybody in the room? Let's see. Victoria Dance. Please join us and... We'd like to limit the testimony to about 3 minutes, if you could, please.
Thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Victoria Dance, and thank you very much for allowing me to speak today. I apologize. There's a little bit of confusion because the testimony before you, there's two testimonies before you, and one is because I was opposed to the bill with 500 hours in it. It didn't make sense to me that we have ordinances for 500 hours and why go to the expense of having a state law and a board if that were going to be it. Every time I contacted the coalition about this, there was either no response or there was no will to change the hours. It finally occurred to me just today that I could ask you instead of asking them. So that's why I've changed my testimony. And I'm a massage therapist licensed in Arizona since 1984. I've been working as a therapist at a medical clinic here in Juneau for the last 5 years. And I was the director of continuing education at the Desert Institute of the Healing Arts in Tucson and have a master's in higher education administration, so I'd like to speak to the educational qualifications in this bill today. I think they should be raised to at least 600 hours because almost every standard setting organization in massage therapy nowadays says 600 or 625. COMPTA, for instance, which has been recognized by the Secretary of Education to specialize in accrediting massage schools, says 600. ELAP, the Entry Level Analysis Project, says 625. Pete Whitridge I talked to today, President of the Alliance for Massage Therapy Education, they think that, he says there's a tremendous divergence between 500 hours and 625 or 700 hours. Starting the law at 500 hours does the state a great disservice in terms of current suggested practice acts based on 625 hours, based on 500 hours, especially with the growing field of medical massage. People at the beginning of the career must have some kind of additional training in the context of medicine and insurance billing, and that's really not possible in a 500-hour program. They're getting down the basic Swedish techniques of how to relax somebody. Then they're sort of given an introduction to a potpourri of techniques so they can then go study those later in continuing education credits. But they, at entry level, 500 hours, there's really not much time to teach them much beyond that, those basic strokes and protocols. The American Manual Medicine Association also says 600 hours. So I think that when I was talking to other state boards, they said that some states are in a predicament because they're sort of, they have to go back to the expense of upping the hours. Ohio, for instance, had to do that. There's about five other states. Only 14 states now have only 500 hours. So a lot of them have upped them. This is sort of a boilerplate law that NCBDMB brought forth in the early 2000s. And it's... and so that's why it's had to be updated. They had something they wanted to market, and this was sent out. I'm not quite sure why they're still suggesting $500.
Have you shared these concerns with the sponsor or the sponsor's office?
I'm sorry if it's been inappropriate to tell you. I have not talked to them about them. I've given them this, but not in time for them to respond to it.
Okay, the bill's been out for a while, though. But
I know. I was working in the wrong direction, Mr. Chairman.
I wonder if you could wrap it up.
That's pretty much it. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thanks again for joining us today.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, Marilee Snow. Not here. Marty Hester, Deputy Director, Division of Insurance. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Marty Hester, Deputy Director, Division of Insurance. What I wanted to do today is just speak to some questions that have been surrounding House Bill 328 and its applicability to health insurance policies. House Bill 328 does not amend Title 21, the Alaska Insurance Code. It would not change the ability of an insurer to write a policy that did not cover massage or that required a doctor or chiropractor to prescribe a massage in order to qualify for coverage. The licensure also would not change the ability of an insurer to require that billing be processed through the prescribing doctor's office or in a particular different manner. Note, however, the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, applies to all class providers and prohibits provider discrimination. The provision of the ACA prevents insurers from routinely discriminating against entire classes of health care providers if the health care providers are willing to abide by the terms and conditions of the participation and are acting within the scope and practice and in compliance with their state licensure requirements. So again, what I wanted to do today was just clarify some questions that have been asked by several different entities on how House Bill 328 would apply to different health insurance policies. I'm available for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
I don't have any questions.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah.
Representative Sadler. Representative Herring. You got off light, Marty.
Yep.
Representative Sadler.
I got to say, Marty, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm kind of, having not asked those questions, I'm kind of not sure what you're answering. I kind of missed the import of what you said. I just wonder if you can kind of restate it briefly.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the question stemmed around whether or not massage therapy would be covered specifically under health insurance policies and whether or not a massage therapist could bill an insurer directly for those services that they provided. And House Bill 328 does not change the insurance code to affect those, nor does it change the Affordable Care Act mandating that the insurer provide those coverages. So
for massage therapy?
Correct, sir.
None of that surprises me.
Yeah. Answer your question?
I think so. And you say 328 does not change insurance law, so the status quo post facto is going to be massage therapists will not be covered by insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it depends on the health insurance plan or the insurance plan. So your plans from Premera or Aetna or Moda, whoever's offering health insurance plans in Alaska, can differ. 328 does not mandate the coverages that they offer under their plans.
Okay. So to restate again, just for the record, so 28 does not change insurance law to mandate or not, depends on the policy, and it does not affect the ACA's mandate to affirmatively cover massage therapy, correct?
Through the chair, correct.
I do.
Representative Joseph.
Chairman, I have a question, I guess. And I assume, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that some of this is contingent, of course, of whether it's a prescribed session. Right. So if a doctor says you really need to do this, that may change the result then, as opposed to someone just going.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Again, it depends on the health insurance plan that the individual has to the level of requirement that the massage therapy session would be covered or reimbursed.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, I'm going to lift my objection to the CS. Is there any further, the amendment? CS. I'll lift my objection. Is there any further objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is gone. Or is adopted. Let me rephrase it. I'm gone. Been a very long day. Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify? Seeing none, and there's nobody online. With that, public testimony is closed, and it's back before the committee for discussion.
Mr. Chairman, is version N inclusive of the N.1 amendment? That is the CS whole, or is it not?
There were two amendments that are now in the right. N.1.
They're in version N.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
They're in the. Can you take a brief?
Look at these. Difficulty, and we're going to be holding the bill over to get adequate time. We had an amendment that did not get out to the committee, and I apologize for that. But that will take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. Come on up, Ginger.
Did you already hold it? Oh, you're okay.
Good afternoon.
Welcome back. And I might add that before we let Ginger get into it, I would request a adoption of version N of the bill as the working document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would.
You have to have the bill first.
Pardon me?
She says you have to take up the bill first.
Oh, okay.
Just pass it on.
We're back on the record. The next item on the calendar today, last item, is House Bill 253, and the version. I would entertain a motion to adopt version N of House Bill 253 as the working document.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, I move that we adopt HB 253 version N as a working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. And version N is before us. Go ahead, Ginger. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell. I'm staff to Representative Shelley Hughes. And she does apologize for not being here this afternoon. She's out of town. House Bill 253 is establishing a new program to license private investigators. A few months ago, a constituent brought information to Representative Hughes regarding the lack of professional requirements to become a private investigator in Alaska and address some of the problems stemming therein. Today in Alaska, an individual can become a private investigator by completing a one-page business license application, paying $50, selecting the commercial code 561611 for investigative services, and engage in business. There are 139 active private investigator licenses in Alaska. 30 have lower 48 mailing addresses, and 109 are in Alaska. 42 other states have varying requirements to be licensed as a private investigator, and HB 253 has incorporated some of those provisions. So a brief summary of the bill. HB 253 requires a professional license to become a private investigator and creates a misdemeanor if a person practices as a PI without the license. It identifies the scope of practice. It outlines education and or experience to qualify for two classes of licensure. Class A, must be age 21, have a high school diploma or higher education, 1,500 hours of work in investigative services. And Class B is age 18, a high school diploma or an equivalent, and be employed by a private investigator. HB 253 describes the information to be collected as part of the application, including fingerprints for a background check at the state and national levels. Falsification of an application information is a Class A misdemeanor. The Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development shall issue a Class A or Class B license card qualifying individuals that they would carry with them. House Bill 253 also includes prohibited practices, such as wearing a uniform or presenting a badge that would cause a reasonable individual to believe that the PI has official law enforcement authority. A PI also would not be able to solicit business for an attorney. Exemptions of individuals who conduct investigations as part of their job but who are not required to obtain private investigator licensure is also included in the bill. In the committee substitute, a provision addressing firearms was removed, and that was one of the things that created the committee substitute. So PIs are not granted some kind of authority in carrying firearms under this law. The CS also exempted fire investigators in part of that group of exemptions, and it removed some of the continuing education requirements because there's no one really readily available in state to provide that education. Private investigators have expressed to our office that they would be willing to pay for the costs associated with the background checks and basic licensing fees. The primary concern for creating a professional requirement for the licensure of private investigators in Alaska is to improve public safety for our citizens. Those looking for private investigators may be in duress or reaching out for help from anyone who might be able to help them with their needs. These are also the kinds of individuals that unscrupulous PIs make prey on. A person in need is more likely to be willing to give personal and private information to a professional who is presumed to have an association with a legal entity, such as a private investigator, and they could be unwittingly taken advantage of. The story that was shared with our office that really highlighted the need for this legislation was about a family whose daughter went missing. It became a very high-profile case here in Alaska. The family was approached by a PI offering services to find their daughter. Later, it came to light that that unscrupulous PI who obtained the confidence of this family was a convicted sex offender in another state, had served many years in prison as a felon, and had a list of fairly long list of crimes committed in other states before arriving in Alaska. It's time for Alaska to protect our citizens by reviewing the individuals who are asking for professional status to collect personal and private information so that no others will prey on Alaskans in their time of need.
Before we get into questions, you've walked us through a few of the things that are addressed in the sectional, but can you take us through the sectional, please?
Certainly. I presume everyone has the section analysis? Okay. And this the section analysis was prepared for the end version, which is the CS before you. Section 1 adds a new regulation of private investigators, so it establishes a new chapter in law. Section 2 is a person may not practice private investigating unless licensed under this chapter. Section 3, the scope of practice, identifies the kinds of information that you can collect as a private investigator. The general requirements for private investigators, you may not have a misdemeanor or a felony in the prior 10 years. May not have been convicted of a crime of dishonesty or sexual misconduct, may not have a dishonorable discharge from the military, may not have been determined to be mentally incompetent by a court of law, may not currently be a peace officer or in a position in law enforcement that may present conflict of interest. 85-130.
Representative Chenault.
Mr. Chairman, as we go through this, could we ask questions if we have them available?
Certainly.
I'd just be curious, under general requirements for private investigators, the first one was may not have had a misdemeanor or felony in the prior 10 years. Would that include DUIs? Or?
My understanding is that any prior felony or misdemeanor in the prior 10 years.
I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I don't know what all the number of crimes that could be considered a misdemeanor. Maybe I'll go look that up.
It appears to me like it's not limiting it.
It appears to me it does. any, no, no, I think that any misdemeanor would be grounds for either removal of a license or not, or not being able to have a license renewed.
Does this take them out of model language, or?
Chairman, we modeled this language after a number of other states, and there were quite a few other states that just left that language completely open, saying no misdemeanor or felony in the prior 10 years, and there were no exceptions of those misdemeanors.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I saw the carve-out for fire investigators. Is there one for peace officers as well, for police officers, so that they don't have to, you know, they're not subject to this license? That seems obvious enough.
Let me get to the right spot here. So on page 10, mm-hmm. under 85300, the exemptions, mm-hmm. it does include news media. No, I think I read too many professions. Can you repeat the question? Which profession?
Sure.
Were looking at?
I looked at this incredibly fast this afternoon. I didn't see one of these listed exceptions, the 17 exceptions, including a detective from the Anchorage Police Department or something like that. Do we need to do that?
The general requirement to be a private investigator under .120 mm-hmm. says that you may not currently be a peace officer or in a position in law enforcement
okay.
that may present a conflict of interest.
Okay.
So I think it's handled in a prior section rather than the
Great.
Than the exemptions.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Yeah, at this point, thanks, Chair. Ginger, on page 2, just because the issue of residency has come up, line 20 says that you must be a citizen or resident alien. Any consideration of making it Alaska residence requirement for Alaska PI license?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think I would recommend against that. There are instances in the state of Alaska where we bring private investigators in from out of state that have special skills or a special skill set that we don't have here. Some of those are investigators that are conducting confidential work for, say, oil field companies, and they go up to the North Slope and do a specific audit. And typically those do come from out of state. So I would hate to lose that level of expertise.
So just for you considered it but decided against it?
I'm sorry, say that?
You considered it but decided not to put Alaska residency in there?
Yes. Yes.
Please continue.
Okay. So through the chair, I'll start on the toward the bottom of page 3. .140 talks about classes of license and the Class A and Class B license qualifications. The reason we established two separate classes is that we would like this to be able to be a progressive profession. So someone coming out of high school may be hired by someone who does investigative work. They can learn those skills on the job. And once they are skilled themselves, they would be able to get a higher level professional licensure. It's just a part of making sure that we have skilled people that are providing information to courts and in our legal system. The bottom of page 4 in .160 just outlines all the criteria to ask in the license application. It does address the fingerprint requirement of both local and national background. It asks for letters of character recommendation from 3 citizens who have no prior felonies. And apparently you can pull the felony list up fairly quickly on court view and see if there's an issue there. But it's really to give a character witness of people that we otherwise may not know.
Representative Heron.
In this part of the bill, For example, height, weight, hair color, eye color, and I'm at this will sound silly on the surface, but shouldn't there be a thing about tattoos? I mean, we require it of other applicants in this field, and of course criminals. We note that. So that was just a consideration. And then going down a little farther in the same section is mental health. Should instead of just a statement that I'm free from mental health, shouldn't there be some sort of psych test?
Chairman and Representative Herron, I didn't consider tattoos. I didn't think about it specifically, and I didn't read it in any other state laws. So that might be something that we could add. As far as mental health, there were two states' laws that I read that did do a mental health exam. Most of the other laws that I read from other states did not include a mental health exam. And I don't know if there might be other HIPAA requirements or some other things that might get more involved. But certainly if that's something the committee wishes to consider, I could look into that.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, again, I'm not trying to be silly here, but given the reality shows that we're, if you choose to watch them, some of those people do need psych tests.
Sure.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. On page 20, line 7, you asked for the applicant's Alaska driver's license. Would you want to delete the requirement to be Alaska driver's license if you're not requiring applicants, if you're not requiring PIs to be Alaska residents? Page 5, line 7.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's a very good point. I would say probably to remove that. It was put in there as a secondary point of identification so that there would be a comparison to make sure the person who's sending us their photograph is really the person that we've identified through DMV as well. Mm-hmm. So that may need to be something removed.
Just Alaska. So.
Yeah, just have a driver's license then. Okay. Shall I go on?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Point 170 on page 6, an investigation of applicants, gives the department the authority to verify the applicant's information. Reciprocity is recognizing that a prior issued private investigator license, if it's by another state, that they can continue to do work in Alaska. And that's, again, when we were taking consideration of individuals who may be coming from out of state to do some specialized work here. Licensed cards, this is an actual identifying piece of information that would be produced by the state of Alaska that would ensure that a private investigator has gone through some sort of check so that they would be identified as a professional, rather than the ability to just print off a business card at home saying, I'm a private investigator and going out and conducting business. So this would be an identification card issued by the state. Private investigator agency certificate. This certificate would be issued if the primary employee meets the requirements of a Class A license, and that way the agency is licensed and bonded. This would also allow them to hire someone as a Class B so that they could basically enter into almost an apprenticeship type program and become further educated in this. License renewal and non-transferability, again, more rules regarding renewing their license, and you pay the fees for the background checks still, and it's non-transferable to another entity.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, my question is about page 7, the private investigator agency certificate. The errors and omissions insurance, we just heard from the massage licensure advocates. They don't have that requirement. I'm just trying to get my bearings about why it's sometimes there and sometimes not. Maybe we shouldn't have that consistency because it's ad hoc and there are different reasons for different purposes. But what was your thinking there?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the errors in admissions insurance, again, we looked at a number of different states. Mm-hmm. That was included in almost every single state to have an errors in and I think if you wanted a specific example, there are individuals online or here in the room that might be able to give you a specific example on how that insurance might play out.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. So dot 240. Well, I might be off just a bit here. We removed firearms training. Originally, there were a number of private investigators who asked to have specific firearm training, and it was brought to our attention that, for the most part, a firearm is not required to be a private investigator for the nature of their business. So we removed that section, and I may not have renumbered my page here correctly.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're trying to set a little higher standard for private investigators than just a person with a business card. Anyone can carry a firearm in Alaska. So would it not be prudent that if we're absolutely asking for a higher standard, that before a private investigator can get a license, if he is carrying a gun, that he has to have at least a concealed carry permit or some kind of training?
Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think the concealed carry permit would be an individual case-by-case business or personal choice if they want to have that. There was concern that by putting a section in law that required specific firearm training, that it would kind of give an extra authority to a private investigator that maybe they should or be suggested that they carry a firearm. And so we removed that section, understanding that there are other state laws allowing concealed carry.
Mr. Chairman. And I guess my question could be stated, if you carry a firearm, you must, and acting as a private investigator, you should have firearms training. May I just, it's just a suggestion, I think. If we're asking for a higher standard, we ought to at least
have a higher standard.
Have a higher standard. And it may not be a good idea, I don't know, but just, if you'd consider that, Ginger.
Mr. Chairman, on that
Representative Hearn.
So, again, just so I understand, is it was in the earlier version, but it dropped out in this version?
That's correct.
I would share the concern with Rules Chairman as well.
And I just want, for the record, I don't want to get in sideways with the NRA. I think policemen who carry firearms have to have a higher, or are required to have a higher standard. And I don't want to do anything to take away a private citizen individual right to carry an arm, to carry a sidearm or conceal. But I think if you're acting in, if you're on the job as a private investigator and you're carrying a weapon, I'm not sure that a little higher standard wouldn't be. You're putting yourself in a little different situation, and it's not just someone going to the store shopping. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
Please continue.
Yep. Chairman, if I can share with you quickly what the original version read. Dot 240 was firearms training. A licensee may not carry a firearm while practicing as a private investigator until the license, it says license, it would be licensee, has completed firearms training acceptable to the department. I'm not sure that the Department of Commerce would actually be the right one to determine that. So that might have been part of the fault of the original bill, but we did remove that, and maybe something similar could be put back in.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I couldn't agree with you more heartily that the Department of Commerce is not the right department to be issuing firearm permits.
Can I? Past experience.
We can bring Don up shortly to address that issue.
I will not comment on it.
Just could I comment on
something? Joseph.
So very, very infrequently in my line of work, there would be need to hire a private investigator. But generally, they were doing research. Sometimes they would be following somebody with a camera. And sure, that can provoke some interesting responses.
But I think some of them don't have any intent to put themselves in any real danger. And others may want to act as bodyguards. So there could be this real variety. I don't know. I'm just sort of speaking out loud or thinking out loud.
Yes.
Representative Schnall.
Mr. Chairman, just on that comment, does this bill deal with bodyguards? Or is that a normal? I wouldn't think that that would be normal for a PI to be involved with, but you know, got to do what he's got to do to make a buck. I understand that.
I don't believe there's at least one in Anchorage that
actually is
a bodyguard.
Yeah.
But I thought I didn't know if he was a PI or a lawyer, Mr. Chairman.
Interesting question.
Yes. Yeah, so, Chairman Olson and Representative Chenault. I'm speaking with a number of different private investigators around the state. One investigator had talked about a number of endorsements that maybe could be added to a private investigator's license. We didn't go to that extent because it started reaching into lots of other areas. Some of them were bail enforcement, fugitive recovery, executive protection. Those were areas that we didn't want to address. We really wanted to get a background check and ensure that private investigators are also not felons preying on individuals. That might be something to consider in the future, but it did look like it extended into a lot of other areas of state statute. All right. Let's see, where am I? Firearms. So, confidentiality of personal information, which is actually Section 240. And this one is ensuring that the private investigator's information is confidential. There are certainly instances where probably people would like to know where that private investigator lives, does work, and maybe they're a little bit more quiet about that. So it would not be released to the public, maybe in a business license type of situation. Prohibited practices. We did add a number of prohibited practices that maybe you could be sanctioned against, or the private investigator would be considered a violation. And some of those were things like wearing a police uniform, kind of as an imposter of maybe a higher level of authority, putting flashing lights on a car, you know, if they're tracking someone. Making material misstatements, you know, so if they get too involved in a story, maybe they'll make a wrong statement. So we did put some prohibitions in here just to keep that business something that could be tracking.
Representative Sadler, followed by Representative Johnson.
Thank you. To this point, Ginger, page 10, line 4. The department may not issue a license if it finds an applicant has solicited business for an attorney in return for compensation. Don't know the legal profession much. Is that improper? Is that a violation of some ethical canon?
Chairman and Representative Sadler, my understanding is that when a private investigator would solicit business, it is similar to a prohibition by attorneys to not be what they used to call ambulance chasers. So where an attorney is held to a particular ethical standard of not chasing down someone who might be in kind of that vulnerable state, the same with a private investigator. They cannot go out and solicit someone who might be in a vulnerable state. Now with Google and Craigslist and telephones, it's pretty easy to find actual licensed private investigators on your own if you truly find the need.
I'm reading this as if a private investigator would be, you know, kind of asking, hey, buddy, you want an attorney? I can get you one cheap. I'm not quite sure if I'm understanding if that's the same thing we're envisioning here. Soliciting business for an attorney. I guess, what's wrong with soliciting business, you know, for an attorney?
I have to think about how this was stated to me. Mm-hmm. The example that came back to me was exactly the ambulance chaser, and it's a code of conduct. So whether they are, if the private investigator is doing the ambulance chasing and saying, here's this attorney that can help you out, that would be one circumstance. It was also presumed that the private investigator cannot go out and solicit business for their own behalf. So,
Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Chair. Is it the kind of thing where you don't want a private investigator looking out for somebody, finding out that someone is doing something shady and saying, I think you need an attorney. So I'm going to get dirt on you and generate business for an attorney to get you out of trouble that I'm going to get you into. Is that possibly what it's envisioning?
Yes. Chairman and Representative Hughes, or Representative Sadler, yes, I believe that would be a very good example of what might happen.
I don't play in that sandbox. So I'm just trying to get, wrap my head around how that could work. So, okay.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and along those lines, some states are a lot more sophisticated than we are. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, and it wasn't me, but I can tell you of an incident where a young man got in a car wreck, and they didn't approach a lawyer about that. They didn't even have a private investigator. What they did was they went to an insurance place, or actually a lawyer firm. They watched police reports, and any accident that's reported, within a short period of time, they have a letter to them in the mail asking if anyone was hurt. So they cut out the middleman in some states by doing that.
Representative Hearn.
Mr. Chairman, Ginger, your boss has another bill that could be, maybe should be addressed here. Should a prohibitive practice by a PI, the use of drones?
Chairman and Representative Heron, the standard response for drone use is it's really the operator. And so if you have a PI who's gathering information that should not be being gathered that way, and if they don't have a certificate of authorization in order to fly and gather that commercially, they should not be gathering it. However, I have a feeling drones are going to be coming up in our world through hobby and through commerce and all kinds of ways. And that's why we have a second piece of legislation that's establishing a task force, and maybe they can better deliberate that. So,
Mr. Chairman, as a follow-up.
Follow-up.
Is in the business that we're here, we have a tendency to put on extra belt or a pair of suspenders, and so could you ask your boss, would she consider that? That is a prohibited practice.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up
by Representative Sadler, then Chenault. No,
I had always thought that the standard response to the drone question was whether or not drones are unmanned aerial systems, but I guess I'm wrong.
Representative Chenault.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just to comment on that, I believe that under the unmanned aerial aircraft, there's also provisions in there to not allow certain aspects. I don't have that in front of me, so I can't tell you what those are, but I would think anything that was unlawful would be covered by that particular bill, whether you were private eye or police officers or any others.
Yes. And
follow-up or
and just candidly, I think whether they're drones or unmanned aircraft, I think we're becoming bilingual. We're kind of accepting both. So it's one of those universal terms now. Okay, Chairman, back to the order here. So point 270 is immunity for complainant. Actually, it's 260. I misnumbered. So this is immunity where you cannot bring an action against a person who's complaining in good faith. So if a private investigator has maybe overstepped some kind of a personal boundary, if it's in good faith, there's no complaint here. Obviously, if someone doesn't want to be watched, sometimes those are the people that a private investigator is watching. And so if it's all done in good faith, can't complain about it. Administrative Procedures Act, this allows the department to adopt regulations.
Could I ask Ms. Plaisio?
Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the immunity for complainants. Is this written a little broadly? I mean, what if the PI punches someone, that would be a tort of personal injury. Or what if they say something bad publicly? That would be a tort of defamation. I mean, this seems to say you can never sue a PI. And I don't know that that's what you intended.
Chairman and Representative Josephson, I do think that the language is somewhat broad.
Okay. But perhaps what you meant was in there.
Yeah, and I might add it shared by a number of people at the table, so if that helps.
Okay.
But through the chair, just, I mean, perhaps if you meant in their acting in their official capacity as a private investigator, something like that.
It's going to need to be tied up.
I don't know.
Yeah, and on line 17, it does say about the person licensed or holding the certificate under this chapter. So it does, mm-hmm. Oh, but it, maybe they're not actually acting in that capacity.
Well, yeah.
I go get a PI license. I can punch you.
Accidentally, though.
Oh, accidentally, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I think that does improve it, improve the language. All right. Section 300 is exemptions. And these are licensing requirements in this chapter that do not apply to certain individuals. So most of these are individuals who are doing investigative-type work in their normal course of business. Could be an auditor, account, you know, investigating expenditures for a business. Attorneys, obviously, are going to be doing some investigative work on for their clients. Collection agencies, there are a number of them in here. In the packet, there was a letter from the Fire Association, and they did specifically ask that a person conducting an investigation to determine the cause of a fire, explosion, or accident also be exempt from having to get a separate private investigator's license. There are only about four of them in the state, and they are highly qualified, and they have a lot of very technical education in investigating fires. And then we have the definition section. And then the technical pieces that are basically telling the department to do their job, a transitional provision. And I think that pretty well wraps up what this bill is addressing.
Well, at this point in time, before we get too much further into it, it's my intent to hold it over until we've had a chance to a number of us to talk with the sponsor. But we have one gentleman that's been waiting here very patiently, and I think we will open up public testimony. We will definitely not be closing it today, but. Any quick questions for Ginger, Representative Chenault?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ginger, just looking, there's a fiscal note here for 253. It's component number 2360. It's for roughly $60,000 to start the program and 15-7 over time. I'd be curious. This doesn't say whether it's to the N version or to the U version. There's probably not a lot of difference there, but Mr. Chairman, I assume that there'll be a new forthcoming fiscal note with the changes in, drafted into the CS. But because I have some concerns when we start talking about ID cards, I think we start, you know, there's not that many, but there's still other costs associated that I don't see in this particular fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I think we'll be able to get Don Habiger back here at the next time the bill's heard, too, on that. But
right.
Any further questions for Ginger? Representative Salberg?
Just a general question. Ginger, I was being serious when I said this is not something a world I've operated in. How big of an industry or operation in Alaska is private investigation? How many folks are engaged? How much money?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Sadler. There are 139 business licenses for private investigators. 109 of those are in Alaska, and 30 of them are out of state. I have heard that some people are, it's a quite lucrative business for them, and some not so much. I know that there is at least one past police officer who is now a bail bondsman who said he's just about tripled his wages as an officer. So I think some people are probably doing quite well. As far as a total dollar amount income, I would not know how to actually gather that information. Maybe the Department of Labor breaks it out by NCAIS code. But
and a related
AICS.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
I know a little bit about bail bondsmen. There's reality shows where you got to chase down somebody. Who is a private investigator's license required to do that kind of process serving or getting somebody back who's jumped bail?
Through the chair, no, it does not require that.
Okay.
Private investigators have all kinds of different tasks that they do.
Okay. Representative Schnell.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, just a comment. Does Dog the Bounty Hunter support this bill?
I didn't get a call back from him.
Thanks, Jim. And let's see. Trey Lewis. This is the only person in the room I don't recognize. That's got to be you.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliation, and you've got 6 minutes.
Good afternoon, sir. My name is Trace Lewis. I've been a private investigator in Juneau, Alaska for 28 years. I was involved with the very first bill that was introduced in the legislature by Gabrielle Ledoux when she was a member in Kodiak. The bill before you has serious faults and serious issues that really have significant adverse effects to the profession.
And you've submitted your letter to us.
I have not submitted it to you, but I had a long conversation where I met in person with Representative Hughes and Representative Gruenberg and their staffs. The first thing is you have a kind of an interesting situation with the language dealing with page 2, line 22. My line numbers may be off a little bit, but this is dealing with the convicted of a felony or misdemeanor. I'd like to talk about an unintended consequence. I'm aware of a gentleman who's working as a private investigator who shoplifted a carton of cigarettes at the age of 18. Went in and served 10 years in the United States Army as a military police officer. Got out, became an Alaska State Trooper. Under the current bill's language, a crime of dishonesty would disqualify him as a private investigator. So I think that language needs to be struck, and we need to fall back on the 10-year prohibition under the felony and misdemeanors. I'd like to also speak to about that for a moment. Their state has a set of regulations that are used for everything from nurses to nurses to janitors to, and they're all called barrier crimes. And that particular regulation is in AAC Chapter 7, and that particular section gives greater protection to the public than just the simple language of 10 years misdemeanor and felony. I'd also like to comment that other states have a barrier at 10 years for felonies and 5 years for misdemeanors. I'm also concerned about the section dealing with a dishonorable discharge. I'm aware of several people who have served in the armed forces that received dishonorable discharges because of PTSD, who came home, who have managed to put their lives back together, and they could not perform those duties as a private investigator, and I think that does them a disservice. I'm also concerned about this multiple-tier licensing system. If I have a license as a private investigator, that's all I need. I don't have an objection to maybe an apprentice license, but I think the apprentice license is when it's applied for by the person who wants to apprentice, he has to have a letter from the person who holds a license saying that he's willing to have him as an apprentice. This agency license is just another avenue for the state to charge me for my own license and an agency license. I see no need to that, especially since majority of the investigators in the state of Alaska are solo practitioners. I also have some qualifications or problems with some of the educational requirements. I'm aware of a private investigator in Anchorage who does not have a high school diploma, who does not have a GED, and is an extremely successful investigator. And he would not qualify under this particular statute. I also have a problem with the language dealing with the 1,500 hours. And I think there needs to be some sort of mechanism or formula in the bill that relates to how you can take a gentleman who was in the public defender agency, who worked in the public defender agency for 20 years, and have him receive credits for his work under this requirement for experience. The 1,500 hours is really related to billable hours. This language came out of the law in California. And it's not really appropriate because the majority of the private investigators in the state of Alaska today have either come out of the federal public defender, federal defender agency, public defender agency, the Office of Public Advocacy, or a form of law enforcement. I'm probably the true exception. I was mentored by an attorney who spent 3 years training me as a private investigator. And this is my, I'm now in this industry for more than 28 years. Single class. I also have some concerns about some of the requirements. About, for example, them wanting to know what my wife does for a living for my license. What does that have to do with my ability to perform my duties as a private investigator? I think that my wife, who's sells artwork, why should I have to disclose that?
Welcome to our world.
Yeah. Why should I have to disclose that?
Yeah, I wonder if I get you to wrap it up, and I wonder if you could leave us a copy of that. We will make it part of the record.
I'd be happy to. The other concern I have deals with the identification card and weapons. The identification card, I think, is very dangerous because it leads directly to a prohibited act, where a person then interprets the investigator as having some sort of force of law enforcement. And I think what's better is kind of what the state has done with contractors. It requires them to put on their business cards their business license number. And if you really want to protect the public, you list every private investigator in the state on the state website so somebody can take his number, look him up, and see that he is properly licensed and insured. The other thing is, in 28 years, I have never, ever had any needs for a firearm. It just is, I think that it should be a prohibited act for an investigator to carry a firearm. I think it also leads the general public into thinking that it's some sort of law enforcement officer because he's packing a pistol. I also have a problem with the bonding requirement. $100,000 is ridiculously low. I can get $1 million policy as an unarmed investigator for $800 a year. I also think that the language dealing with corporate bond, I made some telephone calls. I could not find anybody who would issue a corporate bond for a private investigator.
Could we get you to wrap it up, Lee?
And that does it, sir.
That's perfect.
And about as fast as I could do it.
No, it's
Mr. Lee's question.
Certainly.
Thank you. Do the private investigators want this?
There's a number of people, and maybe some people on the line today, who do not want it. If I had the absolute best of all worlds, I would simply ask for a registration where my name, address, telephone number, a copy of my insurance policy, and 10 years, no felony, 10 years, no misdemeanors, and my license was issued by the state of Alaska. I think that was called more like a registration. It's similar to what the state of Colorado has done. It simplifies the process, and it does still offer a greater level of protection for the state to the people in the state.
Thank you.
Follow-up? Any further questions? Thanks again, and public comment will be open, and I apologize to the people who might be online that we were unable to get to. And with that, we will hold the bill over and adjourn it 2 minutes after 5.